Which came first, do you think? The chicken or the egg or the tax bill? It's a serious question. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. Thursday, November the 16th. Thanks for being here, everybody. Item one today, the House passed its version of the tax bill. Item two, we are, of course, still waiting on the Senate. Item three, and in keeping with our longstanding philosophy, economic headlines like those don't amount to a hill of beans until and unless you know what people actually living and working in the economy think of them. And that, in turn, gets us to chicken. Ed Fryer is a chicken farmer in Rogers, Arkansas. We talk to him every now and then because, yes, he runs a growing business, Ozark Mountain Poultry, but also because he used to teach economics, which makes us happy. Mr. Fryer, good to have you back on.
Thanks, Guy. Glad to be back.
First of all, sir, how's the chicken business?
The chicken business is good. We've had a very good year. Not just us, but the industry as a whole has had a good year. So that's always good news.
Fair enough. One of the reasons we called you, obviously, is because you are a businessman. But also, as we have talked about before, you are a trained economist. And so I imagine you've been following this tax news pretty closely, yeah?
Yes. It's fairly important to me.
Well, talk about that for a little while. What are the things you are most interested in this bill?
Pass-through taxes. To me, it starts and stops with that. Our company is organized. We're set up as an S-Corp and two LLCs, and the companies don't pay the taxes. As an individual, all of that income passes through to me and my partners, and we're paying at a rate of 39.6% right now.
The top individual rate, and if that pass-through rate goes down to 25,
yes,
that's a good thing for you, yeah?
That's a great thing for us, yes. We had a major expansion a couple of years ago, and anytime you grow, it takes cash and it takes debt. We used up our cash. We acquired a fair amount of debt. We're in the process of paying that back down. And right now, under the current tax law, we're probably 2 to 3 years away from being able to expand again.
Huh.
I just ran some quick numbers. If it goes down to 25%, we are maybe a little over a year away from being able to expand again.
And you got to grow or die, right? That's the thing.
We're a growth company. We opened up in April of 2001. We had 25 employees. We have about 1,700 employees now. So, but the growth doesn't happen 100 employees every year. It's lumpy.
Right. What are you going to do with the money that you're saving by not paying that extra 15, whatever it is, percent in taxes?
We use that money to pay our debt down sooner to a level we feel comfortable with. And as soon as we do that, then we'll have another expansion.
And expansion translates into building another, sorry for this term, building another chicken coop, hiring more workers, and well, right? I mean, you know, and
in
giving
essence,
people
yes,
raises, all of that stuff, right?
That's right. Yeah, all of that. Our next expansion will probably be, I would guess, anywhere from 500 to 800 employees.
Wow, that's a lot, especially, I imagine, in a place like Rogers, Arkansas.
We won't expand in Rogers. I think we're at our capacity here. We will expand somewhere, I will say, within probably a four-state area of where we are right now.
Gotcha. As you look forward, though, to the Senate prospects for this thing that is near and dear to your heart, how you feeling?
Oh, man, you're getting into politics now. I have no clue. the only thing that concerns me, and I've been trying to find some information about it on the internet today, Senator Johnson came out and said that he was opposed to it in the Senate because of the way it was handling pass-through taxes. And I don't know if the Senate version has changed the 25% to another number or if they're doing something else. If it's 25%, you know, I mean, obviously, I would like 22.5% or 20% or 15% more than 25. But if it's 25%, I'm in.
Interesting. In essence, this whole trickle-down thing that the White House is talking about works for you. That's the thing that's making this work.
Yes. I mean, we're a growth company. We have been ever since we first opened our doors, and it takes cash to grow. And that's the way we've done it, and so that's what's funded our growth. The higher the taxes that we pay, the less retained earnings that we have, so the slower our growth rate.
Right.
And likewise, if you reduce the taxes, the faster our growth rate.
Yeah. Ed Fryer, the CEO of Ozark Mountain Poultry. Got him in Rogers, Arkansas. Mr. Fryer, thanks very much for your time, sir, as always.
Thanks, Kai.
On Wall Street today, traders did love them some tax cuts. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. We told you the other day about some of the antitrust problems the proposed AT&T Time Warner merger is running into at the Justice Department, centered in large part around CNN. Today, different federal regulators, different media companies, different results. This afternoon, the FCC, the Federal Communications Commission, approved a rule change that appears to clear the way for the conservative Sinclair Broadcast Group to buy Tribune Media. It's a local news story in a way with some national implications, as Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman explains.
To federal regulators, it appears there's a big difference between this.
This is CNN.
And this.
Working for you in the spirit of Arkansas. This is Channel 7 News.
That last one is a Little Rock news station. It's owned by Sinclair, seeking FCC approval to buy Tribune and reach into more than 70% of U.S. households. But the Justice Department may not let AT&T keep CNN if it buys Time Warner. That's so AT&T, with its dominance in mobile and internet, doesn't gain too much market power.
There are two very different signals being sent there.
Al Tompkins studies the media industry at the Poynter Institute. He says with Sinclair,
you have one agency of the federal government that's saying bigger is not necessarily worse. In fact, bigger may be the survival mechanism for media today.
While another agency is challenging AT&T, asking,
now, how big can you be?
Jonathan Taplin at USC's Annenberg Innovation Lab says Sinclair's buying spree will squelch diversity.
A huge part of the population still gets information from local news, especially an older demographic or not on Facebook or Google. And we've never seen a station group control this much of the country.
But the times may be a-changin'. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
The latest update from Puerto Rico goes in part like this. About 43% of the island has electrical power as of today. 8 out of 10 gas stations are open. Supermarkets and hospitals are largely, if what somewhat differently, back to where they were almost before the storm hit. But in the 7 weeks since Hurricane Maria, the island's economy has definitely been struggling. Lizzie O'Leary, the host of Marketplace Weekend, is in San Juan. Hey, Lizzie.
Hi, Kai.
Do me a favor, would you? You've been there a little while now. Look around. Tell me what you're seeing. What's your general sense?
I think the general sense is certainly in San Juan how quiet it is, how many people are not here. Obviously, tourists are not here, but there also just aren't the sort of things you see in a thriving city. There are no streetlights, for example. A lot of people navigating traffic that way. Not a lot of kids. We went to a park. There were not little children playing there, though some of them are now back in school. We did go. We were the first customers at a bar and restaurant, and one of the employees came, like, dancing out the door to us. And we sort of asked them what it would take to reopen and what it has been taking them. And, you know, it's sort of creativity. They're trying a limited menu. They're trying new prices. They don't really know who their customers are going to be because they're not going to be the usual tourists. So they could be rescue workers. They could be people who are doing maintenance. But they don't really know yet. So there is a lot of trial and error going on.
I imagine you're in a big hotel somewhere in San Juan. Who's the clientele, right? Because it's not tourists. Who's there?
There are people here from the Army Corps. There are people here from the various kind of medical services. I have seen folks from other power companies who are here. Yeah, you definitely see kind of people in steel-toed boots and fatigue pants.
Right. The big story out of Puerto Rico before the storm hit obviously was the economy. This has not in any way done sort of the long-term any good, has it?
No, it hasn't. Look, obviously, we've reported a lot on the debt situation, $74 billion to creditors, some $50 billion to pension holders. You know, the other thing that one of the economists who we talked to, Vicente Feliciano, was saying is they had actually started to make some of the painful but necessary reforms to allow some debt restructuring to take place. And then Maria came along and he had a pretty colorful analogy for it. I'm going to let you hear that.
Puerto Rico was like a sick person who had just gone to operating room, and the outlook was actually positive. Regrettably, once we started on that track, Maria comes around.
Maria, he said, could be the last straw for people who are debating whether or not to leave the island. And I would kind of have you focus on two P's, power and people. Power is obviously necessary for rebuilding to take place. And then the people question, young people, are they going to stay? Are they going to go? You know, young people in this economist's family were actually leaving. And, you know, he said, look, by the time the lights come back on, there may not be people here to see it.
So the power we've heard about and you know, folks leaving we've heard about. What surprised you when you got there?
There's some stuff that's really hard to get, like ice. When we went to that burger joint, they were talking about how difficult it is to get ice. And then the other thing is trash. There is so much debris. Oh, wow. You see trees and vines and leaves and, you know, household stuff, mattresses everywhere. We followed some people dumping out their trash. We followed some of the dump trucks. And we actually went to the big landfill. And there is so much of it, Kai, that that's something we're going to dig into in future reporting, is trying to figure out where all of this trash is going to go and if there's room for it.
Lizzie O'Leary on the ground in San Juan, Puerto Rico. Lizzie, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Coming up.
I got in the meeting and she's like, oh, you know, what are we going to do next? And we want to promote you. We want to give you more money. And I said, nope. I said, I quit.
Got to do what you got to do, I guess. Us, we got to do the numbers. Dow Industrial's up 187 points, 0.8%, closed at 23,458 today. The NASDAQ up 87 points, 1.3%, 67.93. The S&P 500 up 21, 0.8%, 25.85. Took a look at the regulatory process for two media mega mergers. So here is a quick channel surf through the companies involved. Sinclair Broadcast Group clicked up 4.6% today, pursuing a deal, as we told you, to buy Tribune Media. It boosted 0.8%. AT&T up more than 2% today, looking to buy Time Warner, as we said, advanced 0.7%. While some retailers struggle to find their footing, as we've been telling you, Walmart is waltzing down the shopping aisle, headed into the holiday shopping season. One reason, strong online sales up 50% last quarter. Walmart rang up more than 10% today. Bonds down. Yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 2.37%. And you are listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Ryssdal. Lloyd Blankfein, the CEO of Goldman Sachs, took to Twitter today to call for a second Brexit referendum. A confirming vote, he called it. Completely reasonable, Mr. Blankfein said, with so much at stake. A whole lot of British businesses share Blankfein's concerns with departure from the European Union due in just over 16 months. But at least one beleaguered industry on the island sees Brexit as salvation. From England's biggest fishing port, Newland, Marketplace's Stephen Beard reports.
British fishing has been in decline for decades, but now many of the fishermen who work the waters around this rugged coast see hope on the horizon.
We see better things ahead. We see a better future.
As a result of Brexit?
Absolutely, as a result of Brexit.
Jeremy Hosking, who catches lobster and crab, was elated after last year's vote to leave the European Union.
For the first time in my fishing career, I felt that we had a chance to get things right again. Because of the way that the EU has regulated fishing, the British fisherman and his community have suffered.
More than French and Spanish and Irish fishermen?
The UK fisherman in his own waters is the underdog.
These waters are potentially one of the world's richest fishing grounds, but since Britain joined the EU, it's had to share the goodies with other member states. Dave Stevens and his four-man crew fish for haddock, hake, cod, whiting and bream amid a jostling pack of European competitors.
There's more foreign boats working in their waters than UK boats, and when I go to sea now these days, I'm just surrounded by foreign boats, Spanish, French, Irish and Belgium and Dutch.
He voted for Brexit because he blames the EU for the long-term decline in British fishing.
We joined the EU, they sent their boats into our waters to fish, that damaged the stocks. The UK had to dramatically cut its fleet to accommodate the other fleet. So if we never had joined the EU in the beginning, we wouldn't have damaged stocks.
Another bone of contention, the EU's quota system. France, for example, is allowed to take 60% of the haddock in British waters, while Britain's allocated only 10%.
Out of 410. 410, 420.
The woman who runs the fish market in New Lynn, Elizabeth Stevenson, has been called the Queen of Fish. Her family firm owns 12 trawlers and dominates the fishing industry here. She agrees British fishing has done badly out of the EU.
Other European Union countries take £400 million worth of fish from our waters. We take £100 million from their waters. You know, it's really very, very unfair.
But the Queen of Fish did not vote for Brexit.
I was not convinced that we could get a better deal out than we have in.
She says fishing is a tiny part of the UK economy, and she's afraid that any benefits for fishermen from Brexit will be bargained away by the UK government just to secure a good trade deal from the EU for the vastly more important bankers.
We've been sold down the river so many times in the industry over the past years. I am very fearful.
192, 210, 220. 220,
much of the fish sold in her market is exported, most of it to continental Europe. Europeans have a much bigger appetite for fish than the Brits. Stevenson fears if there's no EU trade deal after Brexit, the New Lynn fishermen may be able to catch a lot more fish, but they won't be able to sell it. Not so, says lobster and crab fisherman Jeremy Hosking.
There is a world market for quality fish, a world market.
You don't have to sell it only to the European Union.
I want to sell it to the European Union. They want fish. They need fish. Their boats are coming into our waters at the moment to catch that fish. What I want to see is the British get a fairer share of that fish and then sell them back the fish that they want to buy. It's our fish and it's one of our assets.
He accepts that his industry and Britain as a whole could face some heavy weather after Brexit in uncharted waters. But who would be better equipped to meet that challenge than a fisherman? In New Lynn, Cornwall, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
You're probably not familiar with the name Devon Franklin unless you're a Hollywood insider, which he most assuredly is. 10 years in the executive ranks at Sony Pictures, now running his own production house, Franklin Entertainment. More specifically, though, he is arguably the guy in Hollywood getting Christian-themed entertainment into wide release. His latest film is a CGI animated version of The Nativity. It's called The Star. It opens tomorrow. He's also got a new book out. It's called The Hollywood Commandments. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me on the program.
Oh, snap. There's a whole lot to talk about with you and the book and the movie and all of that, but I want to lean right into who you are in this place. You say in this book that the church didn't necessarily teach you to be successful. Hollywood did.
Yes.
Explain that a little bit.
I know. That line alone probably has gotten me uninvited to some churches. What I mean by that is that the church is not a one-stop shop. So when it comes to practically learning how to be successful, learning how to deal with difficult people, learning how to negotiate, learning how to make films, I didn't learn those things in the church. I learned those in Hollywood. So I say that Hollywood made me successful. The church didn't, as a way to let people know that too often we try to say, oh, it has to be, everything has to be spiritual or everything has to be secular. I'm saying, no, I believe it's a combination of both. And in my experience as a spiritual person, it was the secular world that taught me the most that I've learned to date about success.
This will irritate perhaps you and perhaps have some listeners, but it cannot have escaped your notice that you developed your professional skills. I don't want to call Hollywood a godless place, but it's a place that is hedonistic and driven by profit and mana and all of that jazz, mm-hmm. which does not necessarily line up with a lot mm-hmm. of the Christian and spiritual things that you talk about in this book and in your life.
Right, but that's the beauty of it, right? I think too often we put a requirement on an environment that is not what the environment's supposed to do. Right? Hollywood, to a degree, is democratic. Hollywood is agnostic. If you are a spiritual person and you're going into the world, right, you're going into secular environments that do not profess to hold your belief system. You're there to say, okay, if you're being called to an industry, it's how you navigate that industry, not how you allow that industry to navigate you.
What you just said, called to an industry.
Yes.
You believe you were called to Hollywood.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I wouldn't be here.
Explain that.
What I mean is that I feel like this is a part of my purpose. You know, I lost my father at the age of 9 from a heart attack when he died at 36. And my mom didn't have money for therapy. So it was church and it was entertainment. It was Hollywood that kind of helped me heal. And I really felt like, well, I want to be a part of the industry, because if this industry can have this type of impact on me, then I want to be a part of an industry that can actually do that for others. So that was the goal. And when I've seen things kind of transpire in my 20-year career in Hollywood, I do
20 years? How old are you? Get out of here.
I'm 39, 20? Man. Wow. I started at 18.
Wow.
Yes. So I do see that.
I want to talk about this making change thing, because the idea of the Christian slice of the entertainment industry is, it's not new, but it's nascent, I think is a good word for it. Mm-hmm. Right. Did you come here with the intent of building that market?
No, not even a little bit. It wasn't until I became an executive at Sony in 2005. The first movie I worked on was Pursuit of Happiness. The movie was so inspirational and so powerful. I just said, this movie is going to speak to people of faith, because I'm a person of faith and it's speaking to me. And so I put together a whole marketing and publicity campaign on how to take the message of faith to the faith-based audience. The film ended up making $160 million domestic.
Boatload of money, yeah.
Huge. But what it showed me was like, oh, wow, I can merge my passions here. And so I didn't know that until that moment. It was never it was never clear to me. And then from there, did other films like Not Easily Broken, Jumping the Broom, Sparkle, and then ultimately Heaven is for Real,
right. Which
opened up the door for me to start Franklin Entertainment.
Heaven is for Real does quite well.
You
have a conversation with Amy Pascal in which you say, this was great, but I got to go.
Yes.
Tell me about that.
In that moment, man, you know, people think I was crazy, but like, I can't make movies of faith if I'm not living by faith. And so Amy had emailed me that weekend. I got in the meeting and she's like, oh, you know, what are we going to do next? And we want to promote you. We want to give you more money. And I said, nope. I said, I quit. Because I knew that there was an opportunity. Because in Hollywood, whenever you have a hit, you now have some equity that you can spend. And you got to figure out what you want to use it on. And for me, I said, now's the time. So I said, I'm quitting and I want to start Franklin Entertainment and I want you to fund it. And she looked at me and she was like, okay. All right. And what I love about the story and why I share the anecdote was, it took months and months to negotiate the deal. And just about as soon as we're done negotiating the deal, the Sony computers got hacked. And all the information you know, got out. And as a result, Amy lost her job.
Yeah.
And so I share that anecdote to say that, you know, there are sometimes we have to move when we feel that we have that feeling. It doesn't quite make sense.
Because if you had waited, man, forget it, right?
If I waited, I forget it.
Right.
Because the negotiation would got caught up in the hack and it would have been done.
You are obviously very upfront about your faith, both personally and professionally. Do you get pushback ever on that from people in your professional life?
No.
They're like,
no,
man, I just want to make movies, man. Let me alone.
No, not in my professional life. In my spiritual life, I get pushed
back. Oh, is that right? So the spiritual life pushes back against you being part of Hollywood.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Somehow that doesn't surprise me.
They do. I mean, but what's weird is that, and I talk about this in my book, The Hollywood Commandments, Hollywood is a place that embraces difference even more readily than the church. Hollywood is the favorite color of Hollywood is green.
Yeah, right.
Period. So if you're talented, if you have purple hair, if you have a different belief system, but you can use that talent to create profit.
It goes to what you said. You make a hit movie, you got lots of equity.
There you go.
Lots of capital,
so
right.
So Hollywood in that way is very agnostic.
Yep.
Whereas the church, criticizes me a lot, say, well, certain segments of the church, you're just too secular. But I say, listen, if Jesus said, be in the world, right? Not of it, be in it. So I have to be in what I'm doing if I ever have a chance or desire to want to impact it.
It's a movie called The Star, comes out tomorrow. Devon Franklin is the guy who produced it. His book is called The Hollywood Commandments. Thanks a lot for coming in. I appreciate it.
Thank you. Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
This final note on the way out today, Politico did an interview with the departing head of the Internal Revenue Service. John Koskinen is his name. Among other interesting tidbits, Mr. Koskinen said they are building a special safe to hold presidential tax returns, all of the president's tax returns, not just the incumbent. More to the problematic point, though, Mr. Koskinen said in what amounts to an exit interview from a beleaguered agency, quote, beware the collapse of the IRS, which, as much as we hate paying taxes, would be a very, very bad thing. All right, got to go. The Dow up 187 today, 0.8% on the House passing the tax bill. The NASDAQ up 87 points, about 1.3%. S&P 500 rose 21, 0.8%. John Buckley, Deirdre Depke, Eve Epstein, Danielle Irby, Suzanne Levy, Betsy Streisand, and Eve Troh are the Marketplace editing staff. Our interim managing editor is John Gordon. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.